Sound check. Today's date is Friday, March 8th, 2019. The interview group consists of myself, John Walker, and my partner, Jack Jaswali. And our interview subject today is Doug McGarry. So, Mr. McGarry, thank you for agreeing to do this. We appreciate your input to the Dayton Arcade History Project. And I would just like to get started with a few topical questions about, you know, your life in Dayton, where you grew up, and then moving in with specificity towards the arcade. So, for the record, could you please state your full name, where you were born, and where you grew up?
Thank you, John. My name is Douglas McGarry. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. Lived in a house a couple miles north of downtown Dayton, and very familiar with the arcade.
Thank you. And who were your parents, if you don't mind me asking?
My parents were John Leo McGarry Jr. and Myra B. McGarry. My father actually operated a number of stores in the arcade from early 50s through their closure in, I would say, about the mid-70s.
Okay. You mentioned that your father operated multiple stores in the arcade. Were they all together in one area or dispersed throughout the building?
The main store that he operated was the food market, which was right off of Ludlow Street. But then he also managed the nut stand and health food stand, which was actually located on the east side of the arcade, in the arcade proper, close to the entrance to McCory's.
Okay, so they were all food-related stores?
Yes.
So what was the context of your father opening the stores in the arcade? Had he operated a business prior? Just could you give me a little more history on how he began there?
Boy, real rough. My father was in World War II. After World War II, went to the University of Dayton. And as far as I know, one of his first jobs was working for the owner of the arcade, Mr. Shapiro, and that's how he got into the arcade business.
Okay. So, your father opened the series of stores in the arcade. Were they, did he open them all at once or one after the other?
Actually, my father did not own the stores, so he worked for the arcade.
Okay.
I believe the food market was the first store, and then several years after, that's when the health food store and the nut stand opened up. As far as I can remember, they were always there.
Now, when you mention your father working in the main food market, I guess I was hoping to understand specifically what sort of food was sold there. Was it a deli counter, dairy products, fruits and vegetables?
No. Actually, what my father opened or operated was really more of a traditional grocery store. Back in the 60s and 70s, there were numerous specialty shops. There was a meat stand, a fish stand, poultry stand, cheese stand. He sold more basic grocery staples, canned goods, soap, detergent, beer and wine, just more of a mom-and-pop type of small grocery store, not the kind of grocery stores you see today like a Kroger's or anything like that, but really a place where you would stop to after work to pick up a few staple items to bring home in order to fix dinner. Also, we sell cans of pop, potato chips, things of that nature that he would sell to vendors or workers who wanted something quick for lunch. And then he sold beer and wine to a number of folks who were downtown at the time.
Now, we were led to the impression that you began work for your father in helping to work in those stores in 1965. Is that accurate? And or if it's not, when did you start, and how old would you have been?
Boy, that's when did you start working there? You know, actually, my first recollection of the arcade was more that my father would take the bus to work every day, and on Saturdays I would go to the arcade late. 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, with my grandfather. He'd drive a car down. We'd go pick up my dad and also pick up groceries for the family for the week. So, and even then, you know, as he was closing up, I would actually have to start doing certain things, maybe sweep up. Back then, there was people that returned pop bottles, for example, and stack the pop bottles and do things of that nature. Officially, I began working probably about 10 or 11, and that really first involved doing the inventory. Once a year, you would do an inventory of all the items in the store on a Sunday. Myself and my sisters would go down there, and we'd just begin counting items. Officially on the payroll, I was probably about 11 years old, 1966, and worked there after school and on Saturdays. Until I went off to college, which was in around 73.
Where did you go to college?
I went to a college at Ohio University in Athens.
Okay. So, you mentioned that your siblings would aid you in taking the inventory at the store. Could you tell us a bit more about them, number, names, age, relation to you?
Seven kids. I had an older sister, Molly. Next to me was a younger sister, Amy. And then I had a brother, Pat, a brother, Bill, a brother, Ed, and a brother, Dennis. In terms of Molly, myself, Amy, Pat, Bill, and maybe Ed, all worked in the arcade. My youngest brother, Dennis, he was too young by the time the arcade closed, and my dad had closed down the store as well as the overall arcade.
So, you mentioned that you know, your father closed down the food stores in the arcade when the rest of the arcade was starting to close by the mid-70s. What did he do afterwards, like after it closed?
He had a number of jobs, but his primary job was he was a deputy with the court's office.
So, one of the things I wanted to return to that you mentioned was that your father had the food mart, the nut stand you mentioned, and then also a health food store. I guess a health food store isn't something I would necessarily think of when I think of, say, the 1960s, but could you explain a little bit more about that, like what sorts of items were sold there?
But the arcade had a little bit of everything in it back then. If there's anything that would be comparable to it, would be the kind of the Second Street Market, fewer, more just places on people to buy food as opposed to where you would eat. Of course, there was a couple of restaurants. Health food store was a real small stand, but it sold vitamins. I can remember the most, and that was primarily was more vitamins, books, things of that nature, some juices, natural foods like that. But natural foods and all that really came into being more in the 60s. Weren't as common as today, but there was still a market there. And a number of places downtown, actually, that were so-called health food stores.
Now, your father operated a number of these food markets down in the arcade, but would you say that there were a number of other stores operated by others who were in competition?
Well, it really wasn't competition per se, because people specialized. It goes from memory. Entering the arcade from Ludlow Street, you first entered the market, and so there was the market there. As you left the market, to your left was the fish stand that sold fresh fish. Across the aisle from the fish stand was Tasty Bird Poultry that sold fresh chicken, poultry things, as well as would actually cook chicken. So they would sell fried chicken pieces and so forth. As you went east, just past the fish market, the butcher that sold fresh meats. And again, kind of like what you would see in the deli stand, that was fresh meats, and you would pick out your steaks, your hamburger, so forth. Straight ahead, you actually ended the main kind of aisle of the arcade. So if you went left, you crossed an alley that was called the Gibbons Arcade, which is another section that connects to 3rd Street. Right there at that entranceway was Disher's Cheese, so that they sold cheese and so forth. So today, when you go to the grocery store, you may see a case that has all of your deli foods. You have maybe fish, you may have meat, and cheeses. Here, they were actually operated by independent business people. If you turned right, walking towards 4th Street, there was the entrance to McCory's, which was kind of a 5 and 10 store that spanned from the arcade to Main Street. You went further down, and there was, I want to say, Small's Pretzels, which is still in business on Xenia Avenue, but they had a little stand where they sold soft pretzels, fresh potato chips. Next was, I want to say, probably where the health food store and the nut stand was. Then there was Walker's hot dog stand, which was kind of like an open-air hot dog stand that sold hot dogs and hamburgers and so forth. And then you actually reached the 4th Street entrance. Across from Walker's was Culp's Cafeteria, which was a restaurant that had a bunch of stools and tables. And in the center of the arcade, where the big rotunda is, was kind of a general store type of things that sold everything from magazines to cosmetics to just a whole menagerie of items and sundries and things of that nature.
I want to thank you very much for going into such detail. That's extremely helpful. But aside from the stores, you were there after school and on weekends. What do you remember of any sort of entertainment atmosphere? Like, were there ever musical acts at the arcade or any other entertainments that stuck out to you or were notable or even just were just occurrences that did happen?
There really wasn't formalized entertainment in the arcade. I would say where the entertainment of the arcade came was the diversity among the very customers that came through there. And that was probably the thing that stands out most in my mind that you really didn't think about it back then, but you reflect back that when you go shopping today, whether you go to a mall or you go to the Second Street Market or you go to a Kroger's, you really don't have the diversity that you would see in the arcade. And when I say diversity, you had everything from doctors and lawyers. There were many doctors who actually had offices downtown. You had the lawyers. But then you also had domestic workers. You had restaurant workers. You know, the downtown was truly the hub of the city, and a lot of people used transportation, and so the transfer point was downtown, as well as many people worked downtown. And so you had this rich diversity of people, men, women, black, white. Everything was in downtown, and this kind of the hub of all that was within the arcade. The other thing that was existed, and it's thinking back, is really quite amazing. But even within the arcade, and these were more along the outside areas, is there was probably at least four bars. And most of the bars were just bars. So there wasn't like big dance and all the dancing or entertainment and all that. It was just different bars. There was the Blue Lounge was on Ludlow. There was the Cozy, which was inside the Gibbons Arcade, which was primarily a black bar. You had, boy, another bar that was outside by McCory's on 4th Street that I couldn't remember. You had a bar on 3rd Street called the Press Box, which was primarily a bar that a lot of the pressmen from Dayton Daily News went to. The thing I remember most was also all of the workers in the bar were union members. There was a Mindy Steakhouse next to that, and probably the thing was the most amazing. Back then, most bars did not serve food. All they served was alcohol. But when you went to the Press Box, they had a little pass-through window to Mindy's Steakhouse next door. And so you could go to the Press Box, order your food, and they would literally pass it through this window. One of the few places downtown Dayton then where you could, I'm talking just bars, not restaurants, but very few bars actually serve food. So Mindy's was the place to go if you wanted to get a sandwich and a beer. And then last but not least, there was the Marine Embassy, which was across the street from the arcade on Ludlow Street, that also was a bar, right next door to the Dayton Daily News.
So besides going to the arcade with your grandfather on Saturday, what other stories from your childhood about the arcade do you have?
One of the things I learned about business was in the arcade. That I talked a little bit about the arcade proper, but there was also the Gibbons Arcade. And one of the vendors in the Gibbons Arcade had a little small produce stand. And on occasion, if he needed help, my father would dispatch me to work for him, often on a Saturday. And this guy was a old school Italian vendor in a little shop that was probably less than 200 square feet. And when you worked for Vinny, there was no prices anywhere. But he would sit on the stool in the corner with a cigar. And your instructions were to wait on the customer, get them what they need, and when they ask for the price, turn around and look at me, and I'll tell you what to charge. Fine. First guy comes in, well-dressed, looking sharp. and he wants some apples. And he says, well, I want an apple. And I look at Vinny, and Vinny says, well, I was charging 20 cents for that apple, but you're a good customer, nice guy. I'm going to charge you 15 cents. And the guy says, well, if it's a deal, I'll take two. So bag him up, walks out. About 45 minutes later, a working guy comes in and says to me, how much are the apples? And I look to Vinny, and Vinny's puffing on his cigar, says, 10 cents. Guy says, fine, great. Gets his apple. Towards the end of the day, an older black woman comes in. Obviously, you could tell she was a domestic, and she's looking around and looking at the various items at the store, and she says, boy, those apples really look nice. How much are the apples? Of course, I look at Vinny, and Vinny says, 5 cents. And the woman grabs one apple and hands it to me, and I go to bag it up, and Vinny looks at her and says, you know, it's the end of the day, it's Saturday, some of these apples aren't going to make it through the weekend. Tell you what, can you do me a favor and take two more of these apples? They're just going to go bad and ruin all the other apples. And so he says, Doug, give her two of those apples. And go and grab those apples and hand it to her. She leaves, and we're closing up for the day. And I said, Vinny, you told me early, don't ask no questions. We're closed. How much were the apples? And Vinny says, well, tell you what, the apples were 10 cents. They cost me 5 cents, but my markup, they're 10 cents for everybody. He goes, now, that first guy that came in, and I charged him 15 cents. Well, he is a tightwad lawyer who lives in Oakwood, is always wanting something on a discount, and so I charged him 15 cents, but told him that the apples were 20, so he walked out of here, he thought he had a deal. One guy came in, 10 cents, that was the price. Woman at the end of the day, well, she works hard, she works as a maid, and she bought one apple. Well, she has three kids, and so I wasn't going to send her home with one apple that she'd have to cut up for her three kids. And besides, that lawyer, the tightwad, he didn't know it, but he bought that woman apples for her two kids. So everything works out in the end. That was the spirit of the arcade. It was, you know, kind of that old school type of business that you treat your customers fairly, and you remember who they are. They're your friends. Not just customers.
That's an amazing story.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So, getting back to the period when you started to work at the arcade, so mid to late 60s, I understand that that was also the period that Dayton started to experience its own race riots. Could you tell us a little bit about how that impacted the arcade, or if that impacted the arcade, or how you remember that time?
What I remember is really the riots, probably, I think it was 1968. And how that impacted the arcade, and I would say all of downtown, it is when many people became afraid to come downtown and began that overall decline of the arcade and led to that closing. I would also say at that same time was also when overall you saw the rapid expansion of suburbs and more people moving out from Dayton and businesses following them to the suburbs, so to speak.
So you noted that, you know, there was a deterioration of downtown life when the riots happened because of fear. But by the early 1970s, Would you say that other factors such as the oil crisis, stagflation, and specifically in Dayton, the building of I-675 had a negative impact?
Well, I-675, my recollection actually came much later. I'm thinking that was more early 80s. What did occur, and this is actually, you know, through late 60s, early 70s, was the opening of Route 35. And I can actually remember watching that being built. Went to high school downtown at Chaminade, and so you could see the development of Route 35. The other factor was that that's when NCR, there was a large strike at NCR, where NCR occupied a lot of the land now that the University of Dayton is on. So that was huge. There was also, I want to say, the closing of Frigidaire, McCall's, and so it was more the factory closings more than anything else that really had the largest impact on Dayton and the overall economy.
Would you be able to tell us, like, where those factories went? Like, did they move to the suburbs, to other cities, or did they just close, period?
NCR actually eventually left, but really began phasing out of the cash register business, as I recall, and the production so forth, and really moved to more of what they look like today and more of information technology, things of that nature. So began phasing out, actually started getting to like money machines, so to speak. Frigidaire pretty much closed down altogether. GM began relocating and consolidating plants. If you look now, it's on the eastern edge of downtown where the Dragon Stadium is, Mendelssohn's, all those buildings were all part of GM, Delco and Delphi and so forth. So the first phase was to move out of downtown proper and move more to the suburbs such as Moraine. There was a GM plant out in Vandalia. There was plants out on close on north side of Dayton, close between Dayton and Huber Heights. And so that was literally what you saw that phase out of downtown per se. And again, what came first was it the people moving out, the factories moving out. It all kind of happened at the same time. The other thing that also I would say impacted Dayton housing per se was throughout the 60s is when you really saw the development of Kettering as a suburb. Kettering was pretty much farm country throughout the 50s, but then in the 60s, that's when Kettering grew as a suburb, as well as Centerville, Englewood, a lot of the Beaver Creek. That's where new houses were going up. A lot of people had loans from GI Bill home loans, and that's where the growth went.
So with people moving away from downtown into those areas you just talked about, do you think that was a huge factor in the arcade losing business, or did those people that moved away still came back?
People moving out was the factor. So it's not only was it where people live, but also that's when you started to see businesses move out. You started seeing department stores like Elder Beerman's building stores in the suburbs, Reich's stores in the suburbs, grocery stores, everything moving more to the suburban area, less people downtown, and less shoppers. I think, you know, we still had big department stores downtown then, but you could see the writing was on the wall that things were changing. The shopping centers became malls, and now here we are debating what are we going to do about the malls. And downtown is growing, so maybe it's just that circle coming back again.
So you said your father closed shop in the 70s. Was that due to the arcade closing, or was that, or did he leave prior to that?
As downtown was declining, so was the arcade, and the business just wasn't there. There was a decision made to redevelop the arcade, make it more mall-like, so to speak. And so everything closed in the arcade. Redevelopment took place, which took probably 3 or 4 years. So at the point where they closed down the arcade to do the redevelopment is when my father left the arcade and closed down the stores.
And was you or your father ever involved in trying to restore the arcade in the 80s or 2000s?
Not really. I'll tell you, though, my father was at the arcade for 27 years before it closed. When it reopened again, however, he worked for Dayton Municipal Courts in the clerk's office, so would spend a lot of times going over there. And as part of the redevelopment, there was a food court with a lot of restaurants, kind of like what you would see in a mall. And so he would spend a lot of time in the arcade, and so was still, even though didn't operate a store there, was pretty much a fixture there that you would see at lunchtime every day. If I wanted to go see my dad and eat lunch, I knew that we were going to the arcade.
A question I have specifically about the apartments that still existed in the arcade. Did you ever enter that area of the arcade or have any interactions with the people who lived in the apartments in the arcade?
One of my duties when I worked for my father was to deliver groceries to select customers. There was a theater group that operated out of Memorial Hall called the Kennelly Players. The Kennelly Players were, you know, Jim Nabors, Gomer Pyle would play there, Sally Field, Zsa Gabor. We would do deliveries to them in the hotels. But then there was these select few customers who still lived in the apartments of the arcade, and that we would, they would call up. My dad would do the shopping for them, and you'd carry the shopping bags to the customers, people who lived in the apartments. And everyone loved to do it because they would tip. I guess another funny story I heard about, that there was one woman, I cannot remember who she was, but elderly, who just had these enormous breasts. And whenever you went to deliver her groceries, no fail, her robe would open up and her breasts would come out. Well, there was a new guy working for us one day, and we decided to give him the opportunity to do delivery. And he was all excited and wasn't quite sure, because generally it was those who had the so-called seniority is the one who did the delivery, got us out of the store and we could get a tip. Well, he went and did that delivery, and he came back and white-faced, not saying an absolute word. And of course, we pretty much knew what happened, but we said, well, you know, how was it? She give you a tip, blah, blah, blah. What's her apartment look like? And he kind of said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I go, what? He goes, her robe came open and everything came out. Everything came out. And, well, what'd you think? And he goes, I peed my pants. True story.
Thank you. That was good.
Part, all you really see is people that look like you, or of the same economic status as you, generally speaking. Yeah. Arcade was, you would see everything. And I'm not sure how to put this, but you know, back then, and it was downtown all, every day, there was no homeless people. There was, I mean, it's a weird phenomenon. The only people who were close to what you would call homeless were these old, we called them winos. And they would come into the store, buy a little half pint of wine every day, knew them all. You know, could tell you, a little bottle of white port, 51 cents for the half pint and 3 cents tax. And, you know, and they were homeless, I would say, more by choice. Most of them were vets. And probably the story. And the other thing that would happen, and this is the homeless situation, was when it got real cold in the winter, they would come in and they'd say, call me a blue cab. And back then, the main cab company was the yellow cab, blue cab. What that meant was, call up the police department, they'll pick me up, and I can go to jail and stay there. That was where homeless, it was either go to jail or go to the VA. Because most, and there was almost, I would say, there was like probably 10 men, maybe one woman, but no homeless kids. You never saw homeless kids. And it was like, it wasn't until sometime in the 80s that you really saw, that I became aware of homeless people. Which is probably, yeah, I mean, you saw everything downtown. I mean, but you never saw homeless. There was no shelter. Didn't need to have a shelter. So it's yeah. So that's probably an important point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you mentioned diversity specifically, you mean both racially and socioeconomically?
All levels. It's, today, when you go shopping, it's oftentimes what you really see are people that look, dress same status as you. No big difference. Arcade was completely different. You know, it was black, white, young, old. Some people drove. Many people rode the bus. The diversity was absolutely amazing. The other thing that I can remember most vividly, or don't recall, probably the more correct statement, was even though I was downtown probably first 10, 15, 18 years of my life, you never really saw homeless people like you do today. That if anything that was close to what you would call homeless was largely men who pretty much had chosen the life to drink alcohol. We used to call them the winos. And they would come in 2-3 times a day and get their little half pint of wine. But again, you never saw homeless families. Occasionally, the winos would have a woman or two with them, but you never saw children. And the other thing that was probably more indicative of the absence of homelessness was when it got really, really cold out, these gentlemen would come in and tell you to call them a blue cab. Blue cab, that meant police department, and they would come and they would want to spend the night in jail in order to stay warm. The other option, many of the guys were veterans, they would call up and say, I need a cab to go to the VA. But that was our homeless shelters back then. It was men went to jail or the VA, not because they did something wrong, it was because they wanted to get warm.
It's very interesting, like, how you describe that, because it's so different to what I think of, or like you or I might think of the homeless situation today. But you mentioned that there would be these, as you called them, winos, who would come in to buy alcohol in the arcade. would they just come in to buy alcohol, or would they remain outside or elsewhere in the city asking for money or panhandling, as we might say?
They would panhandle. That was not unusual. In fact, I can remember one day my buddy and I were working, and we were, I don't know, just not wanting to work too hard, and it was a rainy, kind of damp Dayton, Ohio day. You know those days. And one of the gentlemen came up to us, and him and his buddy needed some money for a bottle of wine, and offered to help us unload the truck if we'd give him a bottle of wine afterwards. Of course, we jumped at the opportunity, and they were unloading the truck and so forth, and lo and behold, we turn around, and here comes my dad coming out of the store wanting to know, what the hell is that guy doing with his inventory? And we told him, well, you know, he said he needed some help. Well, he offered to help us, and that, you know, he needed a little bit of my money, a little bit of money. And my dad just cussing and shaking his head and said, I pay you to do that stuff. Don't be getting the customers and cutting these deals. And of course, he said, fine, fine. And the guy's standing there, and he goes, well, what about my wine? Of course, we had to give him his fifth of white port.
So on behalf of both myself, my partner, Mr. Jizwale, and the entire Dayton Arcade History Department, 91.3 WISO, and the University of Dayton, I would like to formally thank you, Mr. McGarry, for agreeing to participate in this endeavor.
Thank you. Appreciate it.